Welcome, Cosmic Comrades, to the inaugural episode of what we are hoping to be a relatively long-running Marxist ecology segment, or series, I should say. We're going to be jumping in today to a discussion of Marx's Ecology, written by John Bellamy Foster. He's one of the sort of best known and well-regarded and respected Marxist ecological thinkers and sort of historians of that line of thought. And we're doing this episode today in preparation for some of the subsequent episodes are going to cover Andreas Malm, who's written Fossil Capital and Progress of the Storm, both really influential books with a lot of sort of heavy-hitting ideas, both in the theoretical and philosophical underpinnings of how we approach the questions of ecology and Marxism, and also more specific sort of history and historiography of the development of modernity and of capitalism. So after that, or maybe before that, I don't think we've decided, we'll be covering Capitalism in the Web of Life, really a kind of magnum opus by Jason Moore, in which he proposes yet another framework for thinking man's relation to nature or humanity in nature.
He's also writing a big text on the origins of capitalism using his writings from the web of life. So we're also waiting and very excited for that one.
And I believe that John Bellamy Foster has a forthcoming work as well.
Two things I want to add, actually, is that this is the 20-year anniversary of Marx's Ecology, which I think is a very important kind of milestone for this work. And also it comes on the heels of this past month, actually, his new work coming out, The Return of Nature, and it kind of, you know, picks up off the ending of this book of Marx's and Darwin's death. So we'll have a review in Cosmonauts soon, once I have time to write that, but it should be probably after this podcast is released.
Yeah, so maybe to add a little bit of context about who we're speaking with today and what our backgrounds are, I'm going to do an introductory round. You guys know me. I'm Remy. I'm of no particular import and have no qualifying background, so that's a short segment on me. But I'd like to introduce our comrade, Nico, who I think might have a slightly greater degree of credibility for discussion of these topics. How you doing, Nico?
Hey, thanks for introducing me. So actually, I have a background in ecology and environmental engineering. I first actually came to Foster's work probably about half a decade ago. So his works have been really influential for charting my course as both an ecologist and eco-socialist. And this book was one of the most influential when I first started identifying as an ecological Marxist for really looking at who to draw from and kind of expound upon this alternative history of ecological socialists that have hitherto been mostly ignored or forgotten, and himself, Foster, expounding upon Marx's theory of metabolic rift, which we'll get into later in this podcast.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that 20-year milestone comes back into this because, as we are sure to discuss at some point in this episode, the very concept of ecology and reams and reams of content within that category are all startlingly new. New ideas. You know, it's almost an entire element of the world in which we live, the world that constitutes us, that humanity essentially just didn't seem to notice until literally like the last century or two. So to continue the introductions, we also have with us Matt, who has published before. Matt, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. Excited to discuss this book. I found it pretty fascinating just how deeply he situates ecology in Marx's worldview. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Awesome. Yeah. And finally with us is Ian.
Hey, yeah. I got interested in this thing not only because of environmental history, but also understanding how Marxism can interface with an understanding of the environment and how history is impacted by the relationship between human society and the environment. This text is probably not the sort of text for exactly what I am talking about in terms of this, but it definitely kind of opens up the door for thinking about socio-ecological dynamics and where they originate in Marx's thinking.
Yeah, I think it's important that we recall that, you know, this episode is to sort of introduce the context in the broadest terms for some of the concepts that we're going to be delving into in subsequent episodes in the series, right? Because this is a huge corpus of thought and theory and empirical analysis, and it has the utmost significance, not only for developing and utilizing a coherent and sort of universal materialist worldview, which I think as Marxists is the job, but also, you know, a great, tremendous practical import for the coming century, and if there is one, the century after that. So it's good that we're going into this today. I find it absolutely fascinating. I think that it's crucial piece of being able to have any kind of holistic historical materialist outlook and understanding of the world in which we live, which constitutes us. So to jump into that, I wonder, Nico, if you could give us a little bit of maybe we should start out with a little bit of background on where Marx's Ecology, the work, comes from and some of the history of the history.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of did my own background research to try to, like, you know, historically situate this work. So really what it's in response to is, like, the Concept of Nature in Marx by Alfred Schmidt in the 1970s. So starting off with this, Foster himself wrote in 1994, The Vulnerable Planet, A Short Economic History of the Environment. And this book itself, I think I had a new edition recently, it gets into, like, you know, the role of capitalism and environmental degradation, but doesn't really lay out yet here Marx's conception of metabolic rift. That kind of waits until about 1997 when Foster released this article, The Crisis of the Earth. And this gets searching into Marx's idea on metabolic rift and Marx's materialism. And he starts, I think, in this period, realizing that Marx himself did write on ecological issues, but doing a kind of like archaeology of Marx's work, Foster teased out this understanding from, you know, various works, whether it was the, you know, the economic and philosophical manuscripts of 1884 or the various capital volumes, particularly 1 and 3, Marx's conception of ecological issues. And in this work, he starts setting the kind of basis of Marx's ecology, which came out in 2000, of Marx's relationship with von Liebig, as well as his development of this materialist philosophy. So yeah, I mean, I think that what really situates this work is that prior, you know, a lot of theorists, including that first work I mentioned before, Alfred Schmidt, put Marx as being this kind of Promethean, this unecological theorist. And Marx's ecology is, in essence, a response to these accusations, as well as kind of a archaeology again of Marx's original works on this matter, which have been really lost through history.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, anytime that you're talking about sort of the body of scholarship and thought coming out of Marx, there's always, you know, lamentation and gnashing of teeth at the fact that Marx appeared to believe that he would live for, you know, 500-600 years because he started all these projects. And so, like, a lot of, like, Marxist ecological stuff, you know, is, like, written about, like, a sentence in the Critique of the Gotha Program. You know, like, in some ways we have relatively little of Marx's own writing on this to draw from, but I hate to say this, I hate when people say it, but his method, I think, is where we're getting a lot of novel development in the field. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this really, I think, starts up this entire, you know, literature, not only on metabolic rift itself, but, you know, kind of looking back on Marx's original works, which we'll get back to at probably the end of this podcast. But whether it's like Kohai Sato's work on the matter, or a lot of the work coming out, like, you know, the notebooks of Marx and Engels being released from this, like, kind of later period, or even earlier on as well, Marx really did have a deep fascination for not only agriculture insofar as von Liebig, but this book, I think, really gets into the milieu of Marx's development of this materialist philosophy, as well as, you know, looking at how modern ecology itself developed. You know, you can't kind of, like, move these two apart. Marx himself developed concurrent with Darwin, and understanding this historical context is so, I think, crucial for understanding, you know, Marx's method as well.
Well, and I think we're going to have to thank Engels for, he sent a letter when Marx sent Engels a letter saying, look, you got to reply to this guy Düring. And Engels sent back a letter saying, oh, it's all well for you to sit in bed till noon looking at Russian agricultural details about soil, and I have to sit in the cold bench and swill the cold wine, write this shit about this Düring guy.
Yeah.
So, moving that forward, and we'll get everybody involved in this one, I'm sure. So I guess what motivated Foster, as you I believe alluded to in your brief sort of backdrop there, was this question of, you know, how embedded is ecological thought, a sort of a holistic earth systems materialism along with human historical materialism. How deeply embedded is that in Marx's considerations and conception of history? Or is implicit in Marx this sort of Promethean, productivist, sort of almost like Stalinist unecological developmentalism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really what pushes Foster forward from this. I mean, even in the kind of like 1999 work, Foster started to come to terms with like Marx's work here, and even says this isn't the core of his work. Although I still myself am a bit conflicted about how central this is to Marx's work, you really can't miss the central attention of Marx and Engels to natural sciences. And that's really what, you know, Foster starts trying to search out for here. You know, how was it that Marx and Engels could incorporate this kind of like body of like, you know, natural sciences which are developing so rapidly during this period, so readily? And, you know, how is Marx's work on alienation, particularly of labor, and, you know, similar ideas and metabolism, how are these developed in this time period? So Foster starts to move on to, like, you know, the central role is of Marxist materialism, and that this book itself is really trying to elucidate the foundations of this materialism and how it's so focal to Marx and Engels' work.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's almost like you have to understand ecological theory as articulated through materialism. And it starts, that's because that's where it starts with Marx. And I think it persists up to the present day in terms of, you know, if you're going to understand an ecological line of thinking, you have to start with a basic understanding of materialism. And I mean, that's even up to, you know, contemporary new materialism.
And I think it's probably self-evident to the people here and probably most of the people listening that, you know, any materialism which purports to give explanatory and descriptive power, you know, has to have its feet firmly planted on the ground, not up in the sky. And so, you know, literally we have to look at the ground. Like literally the entire sort of like precondition for there to be history is, as Marx notes, you know, the metabolism of, you know, essentially it comes down to energy and material flows, the metabolism of nature, which is then manipulated by mankind for its own ends, and then its eventual return in one way or another as waste. So that's kind of where that whole strain, I believe, comes from in Marx, right?
Yeah, and I think to go back a little bit, you mentioned the allegation that Marx has a Promethean worldview being used as a thing against him. But in fact, Foster points out that Marx in The Poverty of Philosophy has a lengthy polemic against Proudhon on precisely the grounds that Proudhon sort of personifies all of humanity into this figure of Prometheus in his work, The Philosophy of Poverty, and says that Prometheus advances as he gains new technological abilities and adds this sort of teleological technological progression into human history. And Marx, you know, for Marx, yes, Marx likes Prometheus as a mythical figure, but he likes him as a revolutionary, the Prometheus of Prometheus Bound, who is sort of this figure of subjugated humanity, casting off the chains of oppression and things. But he is absolutely against this idea of a sort of teleological technical progression, and precisely the way he grounds his worldview is in the relationship of nature. Technology cannot exist separate from the sort of external nature that it acts on in the production process. And that's sort of, for Marx, what grounds him, what makes him deal with sort of the nitty-gritty of the production process and of the way that humanity reproduces its mode of existence, rather than just saying, okay, there's this constant progression where we get better and better tools. He wants to think about the ways in which things interact concretely.
Yeah, and more importantly, it's not just that like technology kind of develops through like just social processes in general, but the particular social processes of class struggle, right? You don't have all the different forms of technology that develop under capitalism without mechanisms that are built towards disciplining the worker and exploiting the worker.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is another central point, though, to Foster's work, is that he really draws upon István Mazaros' work on alienation. And István Mazaros drew heavily on this idea of social metabolism from Marx. That's why Foster was so kind of like readily able to draw on Marx's metabolic work in the first place. Insofar as understanding this like second order social metabolism kind of influencing the mediation of labor on the, you know, natural metabolism, as we'll get into later on. And that, you know, how this sort of mediation functions not necessarily towards progress, but rather towards the ends of capital and to destructive ends.
Well, I think that sort of mirrors, you know, Foster makes much, and rightly so, makes much of the fact that, you know, the work of Darwin and just a general like evolutionary theories and punctuated equilibrium and stuff like that that come out of that, that's very much tied up in Marx. You don't get Marx without that kind of thinking. Yeah, one thing about that is that it's non-teleological, right? That it's not headed towards something, but simply that it's a process which is happening. and so it weaves itself out in novel ways, not in a straight line towards progress. And I think we could maybe apply that sort of understanding to capital as a motor and as a circuit, because it's not headed towards anything in particular, but it is sort of bioengineering itself an ideal environment for its own propagation and expansion.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy because you hear, I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard the accusation that Marx is teleological, despite the fact that he explicitly told Ferdinand LaSalle in a letter that John Bellamy Foster mentions in this book that Darwinian evolution dealt a mortal blow to teleology. So mm-hmm. he not only thought it was wrong, but he thought it was dead. And of course, like, Marx was particularly interested in dealing, like, as many blows to teleology as he could, because, like, he wrote his doctoral thesis on Epicurus.
Yeah, yeah.
Who we can also go into.
Perfect transition.
mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about Epicurus real quick, because, yeah, as many listeners will know, and as you just said, Marx did his doctoral work on Epicurus, and Foster makes much of that.
It was a defense of Epicurus as against Aristotle, but Democritus played a really big role in his dissertation as well, because Epicurus was a development out of Democritus.
Right, exactly, yeah. And there's a really brilliant, this is a side note, there's a really good book by a liberal historian about how Epicurus and Democritus survived into the modern world. It's called The Swerve by Stephen Greenblatt. But anyway, people should check that out. But let's continue on this. So Foster, how does Foster introduce the relationship between Marx's materialist ecology and his relationship to Epicurus?
So he kind of argues that, like, Marx was ambivalent from the start of the Hegelian system by bringing up this role of, you know, Epicurean philosophy. And he ties Epicurean philosophy in with, as we'll see later on, you know, the kind of development of the natural sciences, including Darwin's, you know, kind of magnum opus work here. But yeah, he really gets into the role of the swerve, which I'll let Ian get more into.
So, because it starts with Democritus's theory of atomism. So if you imagine just a sort of like blank space, there's a bunch of circles on this blank space. That's like Democritus's basic idea of atomism. And they move through, through this space, which produces reality. What you're seeing is the movement of these atoms. But the problem here is that it creates a sort of determinism, and that sort of closes the door on, at least for Epicurus, it closes the door for the possibility of freedom and contingency, and makes everything into a sort of, yeah, absolute determinism. So Epicurus comes in and says, actually, this doesn't really explain contingency. This doesn't really explain changes in history. What's actually happening is the swerve. It's the atoms need to run into each other in order for reality to be produced and in order for free will to exist, which therefore creates the possibility of freedom.
So again, we have an echo of the Promethean rejection in Marx, I think. But
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's interesting that he likes Epicurus more than Democritus, even at this early stage in his thought. I mean, you know, he had early on been sort of enchanted by materialism. I think Foster points out that he read Francis Bacon before he ever read Hegel, and he considered, like, his conversion to Hegelianism like a falling into the arms of the enemy, I think he writes somewhere. Because Hegel was sort of a conservative idealist thinker, but his thought had all these progressive potentials that Marx, you know, obviously built on. But his sort of analysis of Democritus and Epicurus, Foster, I think, implies and seems pretty obvious to me, was sort of I think Foster claims this, was actually sort of a prefiguration of his eventual break with Feuerbach, because what he points out about Epicurus is that Epicurus sort of rejected a deterministic, totally contemplative materialism, although he was overall fairly contemplative in comparison to Marx, in favor of sort of reintroducing an element of activity, an element of contingency and change. And so this is really attractive to Marx, even at this early stage.
So then can you go in a little bit to the conflict between, you know, Marx's ultimate rejection of Feuerbach on these questions?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so Feuerbach starts out as a Hegelian, just, you know, a young Hegelian like Marx, but eventually, you know, has this sort of break with the Hegelian system where he turns to a materialism in contradiction to Hegel and posits at the basis of that materialism human nature and like the relationships between human beings. And Marx likes this and thinks this is a revolutionary step in the development of sort of this young Hegelian milieu. But, you know, he eventually becomes sort of disenchanted with Feuerbach because he says Feuerbach doesn't take sort of the practical side into consideration. And he says this practical side this practical and active side of philosophy has only been developed by idealism in the past. And he says sort of like the basis for that is human labor and human practice. And that's sort of prefigured in the work on Epicurus.
I think that that's really important also to emphasize, because this break with Feuerbach, I think, is where we get some of the central, just core revolutionary ideas of Marxism. You know, things like the world in which we live is what determines our social being individually and collectively, not vice versa. There's not an essential human nature that determines those things. And we also get the idea that, you know, that human species being that we have, right, is determined by, in the final instance, but not in a crude and linear way, our mode of production, which implies in it our metabolic relation with the material world. So I think that's really important to kind of tease out.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really important to keep in mind about Feuerbach is not only where Marx breaks, but also where Marx really develops out of. Because without Feuerbach, especially the essence of Christianity, you don't have the theory of alienation, right? This idea that religion is this alienated, this final alienated form of the human onto a certain, everything that human beings value in life kind of projected into a supernatural other, to which Marx kind of goes, okay, that's all fine and dandy, but that's not all that becomes alienated from us. Like, it's not just our ideas that become alienated from us. It's our labor that becomes alienated from us. Like, this is the active, this is the sort of growing out of Feuerbach and the whole Hegelian system. Because I think if we're going to talk about, like, Marx's Hegelianism, I think what he's doing, what John Blaney Foster is pointing towards is that what he kind of retains from Hegel is the way, is like the sort of movement through contradiction. John Bellamy Foster doesn't really put it quite this way, but I think he might agree with my interpretation, which is like that sort of, okay, but if there's a swerve, as Epicurus argues, what happens when that swerve occurs? And that's when the sort of Hegelian movement through contradiction becomes a really important part of Marx's thinking.
He combines with this, though, too, like this sort of, you know, really radical time period conception of materialism, this materialism that kind of like undermines this teleological, you know, divine kind of like, you know, power of kings of the ruling class at the time. You know, like this materialism was so influential for these early kind of utopian socialist movements, as well as, you know, just the working class at the time itself.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how complex and beautiful of a sort of metaphysical system that you put together, and I have Hegel in mind when I say this, it retains within it deism, right, in one way or another. There's a motivating principle, a prime mover. In Hegel's case, you know, it's Geist. And so it's so significant, I think, that, you know, to me at least, the Marxist inversion of that and modification of that framework for the first time, you know, enables us to have a sort of systematic philosophical, you know, orientation to the world without God snuck in.
Yeah, I mean, I think Epicurus becomes almost a weapon against this Hegelianism. It's this, you know, really radical materialism that combined with this kind of like sensuous activism of, Feuerbach and others and this more idealist philosophies can really, you know, set us on the right course.
I think Foster points out too, I mean, with the reference to the question of God being sort of at the basis of teleology, he talks about how over the course of like the 17th and 18th centuries, the development of materialism and the development of science, scientific revolution in various spheres of human knowledge was pushing God farther and farther out of the picture. And, you know, all the time, new fields were sort of being innovated in ways that didn't require an argument from a final cause, didn't require a God to be there. And Foster points out that, you know, Epicurus is perfect for this because in his sort of philosophical system, the gods only live in the gaps between the worlds. They live in the intermundia. You know, Epicurus was incredibly useful and inspiring to these early materialists through the Roman poet Lucretius because he had sort of this early philosophical system that took gods and God almost all the way out of the picture, basically sat them in between where everything actually happened.
And in a way, the sort of traditional stereotypical project of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution as it is phrased is sort of to a greater and greater extent shrink those interstitial spaces of mystification until eventually you have a unified sort of realist scientific understanding of the world and there are no intermundia left. That was either a mic drop or a complete conversation killing misunderstanding.
No, we came to the end of that particular subject because I think the next one that I mean because there's a hugely important other half of this book, which is not just Marx, but Darwin, right? Because John Bellamy Foster is so incredibly influenced by the neo-Darwinist movement as well. Because we've already covered his Marxist background, but he's also heavily, heavily influenced by Lewontin, Levins, obviously Gould, and that whole movement, which means that half of this book ends up going into Darwin.
Right. So, In Marx's Ecology, the work, that is, Foster spends a good amount of time and he sort of goes sort of quasi-chronologically through the foundational stuff that makes Marxist ecology as he's presenting it possible. And in that, he's got, I think, a really important section on Malthus. Did somebody want to take us through sort of the overview of that?
Yeah, so I'm sure most listeners are probably pretty familiar with Malthus's work, but the basic idea from Malthus is this idea of human reproduction increasing at a arithmetic rate, whereas food production goes up at a geometric rate. It might be the other way around, and I'm bad at math. And
I think it's the other way.
Okay,
yeah.
Yes. listen, I do history, not math. But it's undergirded. But the undergirding assumption of like why food does not produce as fast as human reproduction is that soil doesn't increase or decrease in its capacity to produce food. What Bellamy Foster is going to do here is really reveal a lot of like the sort of criticisms and different thinkers who kind of blow this open, not just later, but also like even during Malthus's own lifetime, because the essay on evolution was not, or the essay on human population was not a well-reviewed article. He really gets blown apart by another kind of agricultural thinker by the name of James Anderson, who had been doing, I think, a lot of experiments kind of figuring out how to increase agricultural output. And this was, I mean, this was in a period of the 1830s that was really experiencing kind of an agricultural like revolution, because what kind of happens during this period, especially in England, is that not only is there the Industrial Revolution, but there's also this agricultural revolution. And the whole reason why like England is able to just totally dominate in terms of its production in this period is precisely because rather than sort of just going out and collecting resources and drawing them back into the metropole, what England kind of manages to do is deepen its capacity in terms of production. And the problems with Malthus also like that really get revealed is is things like, is just the way in which, yeah, he completely, he just kind of ends up, I mean, even if he was right, okay, like, that's another problem with this, is that even if he was right, his conclusions of the necessity of, you know, the kind of masses to be under these conditions of brutal austerity, they're not even right.
Yeah, I think an interesting point that Foster makes about Malthus, and it's not something you get in sort of the general idea of Malthusianism that is associated with like modern overpopulation theory, is that Malthus doesn't think overpopulation is something that's going to happen in the future. He thinks it's something that's always already happening. And the only way that you like keep human population keeps on track with only the arithmetical rather than geometric increase in the rate of growth of the means of subsistence is through the existence of vice and misery, meaning basically, you know, poverty and the existence of class society. And he thinks, you know, that if you try to abolish class society, or if you try to improve even, you know, just even basically improve the condition of the poor, then you're only going to make more horrific forms of controlling the population occur. So he thinks that, you know, ordinarily population is kept in check by like people not getting enough to eat, or like eating bad food, or like committing crimes against each other, or just by like having lots of premarital sex, which back in the day they thought made you sterile, which, you know, with STDs sometimes did. But he thought that those things keep you in check normally, but that if you try too hard to prevent people from like starving, then eventually you're going to get just massive starvation and famine. And so he thought that was like sort of as a command from God, human society had to maintain vice and misery. And this was a direct sort of attack on the French Revolution, which contained the idea of perfecting society. And therefore, to Malthus, was sort of an attack on the natural order. And then his other, you know, that's his first essay on population. His second essay on population is an attack on the English poor laws. And he's saying, basically, this is stupid. You shouldn't try to help the poor because you're just getting rid of the necessary checks on population. And so it's interesting that Malthus is sometimes portrayed as an ecological thinker when he absolutely wasn't. Foster points out that his thought is completely antithetical to the things that make the study of ecology possible, which is sort of this materialist worldview, this worldview that allows you to actually study nature. Malthus was a parson who thought that the plants and animals couldn't increase the rate of reproduction because they were prescribed by nature and by God, by the laws of God, to stay the way they had always been. So Marx and Foster just have absolutely no time for Malthus and point out that, you know, he's not a useful thinker to ecological thought at all, which is sort of different from what the mainstream of green thought sometimes says.
Yeah, I mean, I was also kind of thinking about how, I mean, if you follow the logic of what Malthus kind of argues, what you're actually going to end up with is the idea that if a single human being exists, there are too many human beings already.
Yeah, it's a steady state. It's like an inherent steady state process. And yeah, inherent to... Yeah, no, it's illogical. He takes an argument from an axiom that he derives at as like a normative thing, as like a normative claim that he wants to believe, a political idea. And then he constructs this gigantic like argument, logical argument from that basis, which, leaving aside the fact that it's empirically incorrect, as we now know in many ways, it still remains with us. You know, a lot of green politics are tinged with brown if they're not tinged with red, you know, and so that sets up an interesting sort of thing for us, that Malthus is with us, and so is Darwin, and so is Marx in a way, which I think has some practical and political implications that we should talk about later, but not to derail the discussion now.
Well, I mean, I think this is really still fundamental. I mean, the whole idea that, you know, Malthus's work here, his essays, really did set the tone for Darwin's work. You know, I think there's a quote from Marx or Engels on how, you know, how Darwin himself found among the beasts and the plants essentially the reflection of this bourgeois, you know, high British society, and this, you know, kind right. of, you know, survival, this, you know, struggle for existence was what really goes into Darwin's original work. Yet at the same time, this sort of, you know, person naturalist background of Malthus oh, you know, God sanctions, you know, the way things exist, everything's determinist. This is the way things are, so there can't be more population, there can't be any kind of laws to help the poor. Darwin's own ideas overthrow this entire, like, you know, divine, you know, ordaining of this nature in Malthus's conception. And I think this is a really, you know, interesting coincidence of Darwin's work not only overthrowing this, you know, divine ontology, but at the same time using Malthus's work and bourgeois society of the time to understand nature.
I think it's also an interesting demonstration of the principle that I find to be true in surprisingly many circumstances and thinkers, is that, you know, we tend to think that the thought and the man are separable, and I actually don't find that to be the case, right? Like, any of these observers are coming to it from their own sort of subjectivity and their own class position and so on and so forth, which tends to, I find that your philosophy and your philosophical commitments tend to flow from your material and political positions, not vice versa, which comes into play for me, specifically why I'm thinking of it what's his name? Latour.
Before you say it, I think what's really worth noting about Malthus as well, not only like can you look at his class background, but his job, professor at the University of the British East India Company. That's all I need to tell you. Like, right. Demonic.
Total piece of shit.
I mean, it's so obviously incorrect. Even the whole colonies themselves, you know, in America, like the whole idea of like this, I mean, as later metabolic rift writers get into, you know, like the sort of like mine at the top, so these reservoirs of fertility really go against Malthus's entire kind of work. Like, he ignores the entire role of the New World agriculture at this time period. It's not even part of his own conception, because it just immediately disqualifies any kind of, you know, declaration about geometric or arithmetic rates here, or this, like, you know, contradiction between the two of them.
Yeah, he sort of acknowledges that there's a lot of productivity in, like, North American agriculture, but then dismisses it and says, like, oh, like, that doesn't refute the general principle, and doesn't try to, like, explain it at all.
He also fundamentally misunderstands things like the poor laws, but that's another story.
Darwin is terrified, though, putting his work, yeah, especially this time of, like, you know, massive turmoil in Britain at the time, of, like, you know, this sort of work, which displaces God, essentially, and really kind of rings true with the sort of, like, you know, radical materialist movements of the time period. If he puts his work out then, it's going to be his kind of, like, you know, throat on the line, because, like, people are rioting against, you know, the status quo, and Darwin's work, in essence, lends itself to the overthrow of the ruling class as it exists. There's no divine right.
And there's permanent transformation. There's permanent, you know, stacking on of quantitative change, which eventually leads to a moment of rupture. So that's an interesting...
There's a but, though, which is that, okay, so there's constant change, but because of the development in this period of the theory of deep time, Darwin's ideas, there's constant change, but it's very gradual. And so it's perfectly in line with the philosophical radicalism of, you know, 20 years earlier than the publishing of The Origins of Species. You know, so it's sort of halfway radical, but it's still totally within the bounds of liberalism.
And it's absolutely, I think, a bourgeois scientific sort of approach. But there's one Darwinism that is that, where it's an endless succession of gradual improvements or whatever. And I think, you know, and also a universal contest between atomized individuals. With those, you know, most fit for success rising to the top, which I think is how most people think of Darwin. But there's another Darwin as well, another interpretation of Darwin, which I think the Marxist ecological sort of school gives us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're planning on doing a kind of series on the, or a single podcast perhaps, on Lewontin Levin's work in 1985, Dialectic Biologist. And this, I think, lays out a lot of these critiques of kind of bourgeois contents and the unfinished nature of Darwin's work. But even at the same time, you have in the same time period, like concurrent with, you know, Darwin and Marx, you know, Kropotkin's work on cooperation and just like this, like, you know, pretty large, like vast literature on like understanding the role of cooperation in even today in current conceptions of like, you know, kind of the stress gradient hypothesis, you know, foundation species, etc. The role of species in facilitating further biodiversity, in essence, the fundamental role of cooperation. You really just can't conceive of this world of, you know, constant competition, individualizing atoms. It just doesn't really work.
Yeah, and as well, yeah. I mean, like, there's also Kautsky's interpretation of evolution. I mean, he's talking about social revolution, but in his critique of Edward Bernstein's evolutionary socialism, his response, his kind of pithy response to Bernstein is, like, you have this gradual understanding of evolution as an analogy to socialism, but that's not even how evolution works. In fact, it happens through, and Kautsky basically develops a very early version of punctuated equilibrium. Like, there's this growth and then there's this fracturing point in which it emerges into the world.
Which itself is an idea, I think, contained within sort of more classical modern dialectics, right? The idea of quantity into quality and stuff like that. So I feel like conceptions like punctuated equilibrium and even more advanced scientific stuff today is sort of like a making rigorous of that idea of quantity and equality.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Darwin's day, though, this idea of gradual progress was actually a really big problem for his theory, because creationists or whatever, you know, Parson naturalists would be looking at the fossil record and would say, okay, we have these really long periods when we have very similar looking organisms, and then we have rapid shifts in the fossil record. And how can you explain with gradual development what happens in between there? And if you have this sort of very gradualistic version of Darwinism, you can explain that. And you just have to try to figure out the fossils that go in the middle, but the timeline never really works out. You have to come up to a conception of rapid leaps, revolutions in evolutionary time, to be able to explain that and to be able to defend Darwinism as a theory itself.
Yeah, and even more, I mean, there's the other criticism of, like, why are human beings not evolving as well, if you have this, like, gradual thing. But a punctuated equilibrium kind of explains why there's these long periods of stasis, but also, like, humans have evolved in a lot of ways. I mean, like, there was that, whenever you see, like, these reconstructions of, like, ancient human beings, I mean, there was, like, a 15-year-old girl that they found, and they reconstructed what she looked like, and called Argi, A-R-G-I, and she's much, much different from what human beings look like now.
And she was an anatomically modern human, not a different hominid.
Yeah, and so you see, like, gradual changes, because I think, her skull was a lot thicker, and, like, her bones were, like, larger than, like, a modern 15-year-old, which is probably because of some sort of selecting mechanism that has kind of gone away that was there at the time that made, you know, people a lot bigger. I mean, you look at the difference between domesticated and undomesticated foxes. You know, there's, they don't develop in the same way, because what's actually being selected for when you're domesticating something is an underdeveloped adrenal gland.
I think, you know, one of the prime examples that we can point to as a simple, I'm sure there are better ones, but, like, a simple example from, you know, physical anthropology is we know from, you know, even the relatively recent fossil record for anatomically modern humans, that the human foot used to be more robust and now it's more gracile. And the transformation happened about at the time that shoes were invented. We know that when we externalized part of our metabolism with cooking and meat consumption increased, right? We know that that's when most of the evolution of our like neocortex and frontal lobe happened, that enabled us to develop technology. Like, these are things that we know that are in fact examples of evolution with anatomically modern humans.
I was just going to say, if we're going to mention human origins, another important point of interface between Marxism and Darwinism is Engels' groundbreaking essay, The Part Played by Labor in the Transition from Ape to Man, where he lays out a position that Foster says is very close to the modern sort of consensus on human origins, which is the idea of gene culture coevolution, where sort of the labor process or sort of the social existence or and natural existence of human beings sort of evolves along with their genetic makeup and their physical form.
Yeah, external inheritance is like really fundamental to this like extended evolutionary synthesis in the past even three decades. But I mean, kind of reeling back to this time period, I mean, we talk about evolution, especially of humans, but this is like concurrent in the first time we find an actual, like, you know, ancient human or one of our, you know, progenitors. You know, this is like, what is it? It's the exact time period after Darwin releases his thesis on the origin of species. We start to find, you know, the ancestor of humans in these kind of fossil records. Even then, like with Cuvier and others, you know, we had these ideas of, you know, species going extinct and shifting the past, but these weren't really ironed out until pretty much coterminously with, you know, Darwin and Marx. So this is, I think, still so forward thinking at the time, especially Engels' work on part played by labor in the evolution of man. This is like super, super forward thinking. I can't stress that enough.
I think an interesting point that Foster makes in the book is that when people were sort of reconstructing these sort of early hominid ancestors of human beings, they expected to find brains getting bigger before bipedalism and the use of the hands for labor, because they thought that, okay, you get really smart and then you figure out how to do things with your hands, you know. But Engels had claimed the opposite in his essay. And then when they actually started finding these remains and started reconstructing these things, they found that it was the use of the hands and the freeing up of the hands for labor that allowed for the sort of social organization that required a bigger brain.
Theory and practice.
Right, which again, so this is just straight up, yeah, this is just straight up like historical materialism. Like, it seems to me just further and further we get with, the ability, as we go down the scientific timeline here, it was a rapid, a paradigm shift between, you know, finally being able, like having the actual resources and tools and capabilities to develop a scientific theory of history and society. Like literally that happened all so quickly that while, you know, people like Marx and Darwin were living, and it's just like the evidence for it just seems self-evident to me. The more I learn about various fields of natural sciences and the social sciences, to the extent those can be separated, it's just obvious, right, that material conditions precede social being.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, we start to find really this work by Foster, just like the environment in which, you know, Marx was developing his ideas was the same time as Darwin developing his ideas. These can't be kind of like, you know, taken apart. They still have very similar, you know, influences. And just, I mean, you really see the foresight of Marx and Engels in this time period when you start to like, kind of like situating them to what's going on. This is a time of rapid change in the biological, ecological sciences before these even names really existed, honestly.
Yeah, and I found one point that I really like that John Bellamy Foster makes about the relationship between Darwin and Marx is class struggle and natural selection, where he says that natural selection kind of explains why certain technologies, why certain social relations and configurations of human social life win out, and why others decline, which is such a great way of dealing with so many different historical questions. Why is it that class struggle is the mechanism within which natural selection functions in human social structures?
Well, and it points out very importantly, in contradistinction to the bourgeois interpretation of Darwin, Marx's interpretation of that with regard to forms of social organization, correctly, in my view, views society as the system, society as the level of reduction for organism, not the individual. Mm-hmm. Like these systems under Marx are not reducible to individuals because that's an unintelligible, that's just part of a larger system. It's an unintelligible unit for observation. And instead we replace that with, you know, what systems of social organization are viable and what aren't, which I think is a huge breakthrough.
Yeah, I was just going to say like a statement on like, because later on we're going to talk about Jason Moore and talk about the idea of environmental history as instead of the environmental history of. So you can kind of we'll talk about that in a later podcast. But if you think about this in terms of like world systems analysis, so it, for example, why does a certain geographical unit become a global hegemon against other units within the European state system? Or why is it that these small geographical units where capitalism developed, why are they able to totally outcompete and take and dominate and colonize the rest of the world? And it's because of like their structure, that like the social structure that is there incentivizes certain ways of going out, right? Like you're a smaller state, okay, you don't have access to an awful lot of resources, so what's the best way to get a bunch of grain? Well, since we've been incentivized to kind of alter our behavior because of our lack of grain, let's go to, there would be a better way to put this, but it's off the cuff. But like, let's instead go to the Ottoman Empire and form a little and start, you know, shuffling off grain through a contraband trade. And then all of a sudden, these really, really old societies that had existed as distinct, you know, tributary societies start to experience like crisis as these little societies end up building up, right? And so there's these kind of incentives that are conditioned by environmental and geographic conditions, which drive them to act in certain ways that undermine other social forms.
There's an interesting, since we're talking about world systems anyway, I don't think it was Giovanni Arrighi who wrote the long 21st century, but it was one of his colleagues, one of his contemporaries who did the thing I'm talking about, but goddamn if I can't remember his name. The question was, and it was like a public forum, a public debate actually, between one of those, you know, conservative assholes who's all like, well, you know, the Western tradition is why, you know, we're on top of the world system and da-da-da. And the WSA guy was like, oh, that's not the case. So the question was, why did capitalism and modernity sort of arise in Europe rather than China? And we know that, you know, the area, the geographical and social area we think of as China now was in fact the wealthiest place in the world for the longest period of time. And like, I'm putting this badly, I'm sure, but the world system guys, you know, answer to that essentially was that, you know, there was a stable circuit of resource extraction, modification, distribution, and return in a wealthier, less population dense geographical region like what's now China. There were higher sort of selection pressures in Europe, which, you know, various historical mechanisms over a very long period of time sparked the sort of evolutionary mutation of or creation of certain self-perpetuating circuits of energy and material flows, which eventually become, you know, what we understand as capitalism in its earliest iteration when it was, you know, maybe capitalism in the time of Marx. And then, of course, you know, we later get into a world capitalist system such as described by people like Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, Hilferding and folks like that. So I just find that really fascinating because this is a direct like connection between Darwinism as a social, like when looked at from the social lens, and then also, you know, theory of evolution, historical materialism, and ecology.
Yeah, it's kind of like why it's almost like when I think of the history of capitalism and then I think about evolution, I think of like, you know, if anyone's ever read the long 20th century, like Arrighi has this idea of like these small Italian city states, and then the slightly bigger but not that big Dutch Republic, and then this also slightly bigger but not that big British or England takes over, and then the really big America takes over, and it's almost like watching the evolution of like huge predators in like the Triassic period. It's like you have this like constant development of like, oh, there's these little predators and they just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Well, I mean similarly, we find these kind of like nexuses, I think they get into, of like various technologies, these kind of autocatalytic loops, which actually have a similar origin in ecology, insofar as, you know, like how once these things connect to each other, it's this kind of like, you know, feedback loop that keeps intensifying. And I think they contextualize this with, you know, like the kind of like city states in Germany and Italy, and why per se capitalism developed as it did. But they have these direct, you know, kind of metaphors for ecology and vice versa that I think are really, really fascinating. But we should probably get back to, I think, to like the metabolic rifts and talk about materiality of social structures.
That's okay. I think listeners will have enjoyed our little discursions here.
All right, fair enough. Do we want to jump into that, though, or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you want to take it away?
Okay. So I think this is really the fundamental kind of like, you know, signal moment for Marx's ecological critique. So it really starts out with, you know, him studying the works of von Liebig, who put out in the 1840s this book on agricultural chemistry, really looking at the kind of like soil chemistry of, at the time, high British agriculture. And Marx and Engels credit him as developing from the point of view of the natural sciences this negative or destructive side of modern agriculture. And this starts to occur where we start connecting social relations with these ecological cycles, particularly the role of soil nutrients. And if anyone else wants to jump in, go ahead.
Well, one thing, and I'm probably skipping ahead or taking out of context here, but I think, you know, with regard to soil chemistry, one of the fundamental and really, frankly, simple observations that we get in Marx, and I can't remember where, that touches on this idea of energy and material flows, is this observation that as the working class is, you know, as a new mode of production arises in capitalism and enclosure happens and all the various pressures that force a formerly dispersed and agrarian population into cities to work in industrial production, what ends up happening is, you know, a great mass of food is required to sustain that population. And so this makes itself felt or has the consequence or byproduct of disrupting the flows of, I want to say he used nitrogen as the example here, which, you know, has to be, you know, food has to be grown using it in the country. And it all ends up in this imbalance, this original metabolic rift in the cities as waste. And so this creates a rift between how we metabolize nature. So that's one of the fundamental ideas. But I don't actually know if that was from the Liebig section or not.
I will give you more context. That's the kind of the spatial and historical development of Marx's ideas, particularly in this, like, you know, high British agriculture and this kind of rift between town and country, which I think plays a huge role in their work, especially in the manifesto, if I recall.
Yeah.
But similarly, this comes from a temporal rift insofar as how, you know, capitalism itself is developing at such a fast pace that it's, you know, exhausting these soils, not allowing the kind of like, you know, reconditioning of the nutrients by natural processes. So you have this kind of spatial and temporal profile of capitalism, this sort of metabolism, as Marx calls it, drawn the work of von Liebig. So von Liebig uses the term metabolism to really understand this kind of like, you know, transformation, this kind of intake and shift, and even like, you know, secretion through as pollution from the organic metaphor within a organism. But he turns it into, you know, the metabolism of nature in Marx's work, understanding this kind of like, you know, natural flows, natural cycles of nutrients, whether it's the nitrogen here or phosphorus or, for example, carbon in regard to the climate system. But he sees this natural kind of flow that man himself, you know, relies upon. This is the universal metabolism of nature. So Marx goes from here to develop this sort of social metabolism and understanding how man, mediated through labor, draws upon this sort of, you know, nature substratum to transform it through his own actions to commodities or use values, what have you. And he understands this, like, you know, transformation as being socially conditioned by various modes of production, particularly, you know, feudal periods, or in a capitalism as manifesting through this kind of spatiotemporal profile of capital and ceaseless expansion and, you know, temporal increase of this metabolic rift. So Marx, of course, reading this work by Liebig and others, and kind of during this period of critiquing Malthus, starts to understand how British agriculture, high British capitalist agriculture, is creating this crisis of this metabolic rift where the nutrients are no longer being restored to the soils, where they start drawing from, you know, more broadly, you know, the literal, like, you know, tombstones, the battlefields, Napoleonic wars, in order to kind of, like, you know, buffer these soils and add an extra, you know, nutrient source. They're just destroying their soil fertility. And as time goes on, as we might mention later, you know, this causes the first development of ecological imperialism of these, you know, islands that of, you know, like whether it's birds or even bats, creating guano.
Guano.
How they start trying to control these islands throughout, you know, South America and Africa and all around the world. And this really creates like these, like, you know, really horrendous wars in South America for these, you know, your residual reserves of this just accumulated guano, because British agriculture is destroying the fertility, not returning it at all to soils, which is what Liebig critiques them for. But furthermore, they need to find the bones from these battlefields in order to maintain productivity as such. So this is really the start of, like, Marx's ecological critique, and it coalesces in this idea of metabolic rift.
Well, and it's important to point out, I was just thinking, this is, you know, this isn't just to draw out the implication here just briefly. This is an example, a concrete, you know, manifestation of the sort of co-constitution of man and nature. So it's not even like that. Like, what I'm trying to point out here is that it's not, I don't believe, you know, the Marxist framework presents it as there is mankind and then there is this material substratum that we just shape and it's inert. Instead, we can see history in this light as being co-constituted both by the social body metabolizing what it views to be external nature, but then external nature shaping the social organism.
I don't think we really introduced who Justus von Liebig was, so I was going to do that for a bit. Justus von Liebig was a German biochemist who Marx originally turned to his work because he was the originator of this sort of insight in agriculture, of a really first scientific investigation into soil chemicals. And he's the one who originated the idea that you need these three major soil chemicals to have productive agriculture. You need phosphorus, you need nitrogen, and you need potassium. And applying these basic methods of Liebig of regulating these chemicals was incredibly beneficial to agriculture when it was first done. I mean, it had diminishing returns later, but you know, when you just basically know a simple thing you can do, you can greatly increase yields. And this was a pretty easy thing to throw in Malthus's face. Like, okay, I mean, you think plants can only increase at a very sort of steady rate in their populations, while human beings can increase geometrically. Well, you're completely ignoring this natural fact that can explain part of that, which is soil chemicals. But then later, Liebig start seeing the diminishing returns from this method of capitalist agriculture, and he becomes a very sharp critic of capitalist agriculture, centering on this division between town and country, this metabolic rift, as Marx develops it, that we were just talking about, where you have sort of the soil being robbed of its nutrients by having food exported from the countryside into the cities, and then you have people eat the food and produce waste, and then the waste just goes into the river and pollutes it, and none of the nutrients are actually returned to the soil, and the cycle is not repeated. There's no feedback. There's no natural feedback keeping the soil fertile. So you have to keep pillaging these guano islands. And I think, to put some numbers to the guano island thing, Foster says that U.S. capitalists in the 19th century seized 93 guano islands in, I think, mostly around South America. The State Department recognized 66 of them as U.S. possessions, and the U.S. still possesses four of them today.
Right, even when we use all synthetic fertilizers.
Well, that's a huge point, too, though. Like, this you know, Haber-Bosch process, really fixing atmospheric nitrogen, this goes into the further understanding of the metabolic rift, although this is not by Marx, but by Foster at all. you understand the spatiotemporal profile of how kind of capitalism plays this, a ball and cup routine of moving it all around. And at the same time, in capitalism, you have this massive destruction of ecosystems through nutrient pollution, nutrification. You have this massive influx, too, of from Haber-Bosch process causing this. And then we're losing our soils constantly as well. So it's the kind of simultaneous destruction of soil and over nutrient pollution. It's absurd.
Well, I was gonna ask Nico. You might know this. So the two largest. I know that the two largest stretches of black soil on the planet, like the most productive soil that you could possibly have, naturally occurring soil you can have, is in Russia, and it's very old. It's near they discovered it near old Novgorod or something like that. Hundreds of years ago, and it sustained that whole area of food for hundreds and hundreds of years. But how quickly did America use up its black soil? Because the other largest pocket is in the Midwest, right? And I was wondering, because you might know this, how quickly?
So quick, it was less than 60 years. I mean, it was from the original kind of fragmentation of this West. And that's actually another work by one of Foster's kind of progenitors. Was this work on the Dust Bowls of Empire, and that really goes into this kind of role of capital in America at the time, and colonialism, and just literally mining this topsoil. This isn't any kind of sustainable agriculture. It's mining this layer upon layer of these rich dark soils in order to serve as a breadbasket of the world.
Well, and so this calls into our attention, something. I was reading something by Nick Estes recently, and it's, people don't realize there were, at least 100 million people in advanced civilizations on the North American continent alone prior to, contemporaneous to the Columbian transfer. But clearly there was some mode of production and social mode of social organism present in indigenous societies, which to a great extent, greater or lesser extent, was able to manage the metabolism of nature within that social organism to at least some degree of sustainability, under actually conditions of really highly complex planning and economy as far as, production and diversification of labor and stratification and so on and so forth. So it's interesting, parallel to this discussion of artificial fertilizers, first, made possible by the Haber-Bosch nitrogen fixation process. I would say, and this is not my idea. I believe this is out of Moore, if I'm not mistaken. It, as analogous to that process is the addition of carbon to the production process. And so it almost gives the illusion of freeing us from the requirement to expend corporeal labor, whether in form of a draft animal or a human being, a slave or a worker. It gives us the illusion of freeing us from this one-to-one sort of relationship with material energy expenditure. And so by loosing the relationship between energy expenditure and production, we've ended up with this hugely, hugely asynchronous, that's not the word, asymmetrical flow of energy and materials, which is just sort of part of the explanation of what is utterly catastrophic about climate and ecological disruption today. But I just want to throw that in there.
Yeah. I mean, Malm's work, False Capital, gets really into that kind of role of, these reservoirs of energy through, literally ancient, flora and fauna that, became oil and coal, and how this sort of matches the spatiotemporal profile of capital itself. And it's endless self-valorization and just, ceaseless expansion. But how this kind of in turn catalyzes this, metabolic rift in the carbon cycle itself,
which grows exponentially. It becomes exponentially more asynchronous every cycle.
Yeah. I mean, certainly in this regard, we can't understand nature in the terms of parson naturalists or even early ecologists of this kind of one-to-one ratio, but it's very non-linear and essentially chaotic. There's this quote by this climatic scientist Wallace Broker, who essentially argues that, you know, this like climate system is like an ornery beast, this angry, you know, animal that the tiniest of like, you know, poke, whether it's by like, you know, the increase of carbon to the atmosphere, could cause a massive overreaction. And looking at the kind of like long history of our planet's climates, this sort of massive increase of carbon and various nutrients to the planet itself, the sort of, you know, appearance of these metabolic rifts is pushing at the sort of boundaries of what allows us as a species to survive. So this is where I think the metabolic rifts kind of, you know, understanding or analysis can be really useful in understanding how our disruption of these cycles that have hitherto existed with the, you know, role of organisms themselves and maintaining them, how they become disrupted and disconnected, resulting in this, you know, horrible, horrible disaster we're in now, where the Amazon is, I think, still smoldering. We have, you know, fires going throughout Siberia, the highest, you know, recorded history of humans, I think, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, north of the equator occurring. Right now, I mean, we are in probably one of the most tumultuous periods of Earth history that we've seen so far.
And the good, you know, the only silver lining here for us as communists and as Marxists is probably the fact that given this, you know, I think correct understanding, the Marxist understanding of the nature of the relationship between humanity and nature, right? What that inevitably sort of suggests is that there is the only possible solution is a unity of kind of like ends and means, meaning that like in order to amend the situation, it's entailed within the problem that we have to create a society which centers these, you know, the lack of these sort of exploitative and destructive property and production and social relation regimes, right? So like in order to address the problem, we have to enact the sorts of things that we as eco-socialists, as communists would be aiming for anyway. So like there's one slim hope for humanity as far as the way I look at it, and it's basically communism, like intentional, conscious, you know, democratic collective social planning in a sustainable way.
Yeah, I mean, that really gets into, I think, what has been the most fascinating, I think, development in the past few decades for like kind of like Marxology has been the release of like, you know, Marx's notebooks. And I think one of the people who really does a lot of work for it is Kōai Saito. He wrote Karl Marx's Eco-Socialism. Anyways, he's been kind of the spearhead of this attempt to, you know, translate a lot of these notebooks from the late period of Marx. And you see here, you know, this attempt to understand how do we heal this rift? You know, how do we address the ways in which, you know, the current, you know, social order, this mode of production mediates the metabolic interaction between man and nature? So to answer that question, I think, well, how Marx was trying to answer it was he wanted to look more and more at, like, you know, non-Western, non-capitalist kind of, you know, ontologies, ways of being, metabolisms. And in this manner, he started, at the very end of his life, he started learning Russian rapidly, like his life depended upon it, and started getting really into understanding the role of these, you know, Russian ancient kind of, you know, communal societies, agrarian societies that, you know, still existed concurrent with the development of capitalism in Russia, as slow as it might have been, but simultaneously had managed to maintain themselves for these long, long histories. And he saw how Kōai Saito, a follow-up to Marx's work here, Marx notices here, like, this kind of alternative way to socialism that doesn't require this, you know, sort of, you know, stageist conception of capitalism being a, or, you know, not a ceaselessly, you know, progressive motion process. You know, this rift theory here really starts this kind of like, you know, critique by Marx of this linear progressive rhetoric when he sees the ways in which capitalist agriculture undermines the very basis of society. So this is like, again, this is a signal shift in Marxist thought, I think, and still relatively applicable to the current crises, as we've seen by, you know, the various colleagues of Foster and others.
I think one thing to point out, maybe, and this is a great sort of merit of Foster's work, is that it's not just that, you know, we're already communists and we want communism for universal human emancipation. And then we also have an ecological crisis on the side. And, oh, isn't it just convenient that communism also happens to be the solution to that? I think what Foster does is he really shows how that's sort of the whole point from the beginning, and that this is something that that is central to Marxism and to communist politics, is it's about sort of humanity gaining sort of rational control over its social metabolism, and that humanity right. is going to have to like interface with nature and is going to have to produce no matter what. And what communism is about is it's about allowing us, it's about giving us the preconditions for being able to do that in a way that's not undermining its own foundations.
Yeah, I mean, to me, and you know, that you're explaining, you know, that Foster was sort of articulating in there, in a way, right? That is the this is not, like you said, this is not, you know, an ecological sustainability is not incidental to our project or a consideration that we'll have to take almost as an inconvenience, right? It instead, you know, is unified into the very nature of the project of becoming for the first time truly and fully human, in the sense that, you know, it's sort of the gauntlet thrown down for intelligent life, if there, you know, even if there is intelligent life of a similar sort somewhere else, right, is to transcend these sort of unconscious determinations that we are unaware of that shape and limit, you know, what we are as social, as a social organism. Instead, it's to sort of transcend that, take conscious, you know, control over our being and role in history, and do that in such a, and so really to become collectively self-conscious and free for the first time. So that, you know, entailed within that is managing our collective metabolism of nature, which is, again, you know, within, baked into that proposition is the idea of creating these sorts of equitable and emancipatory social relations.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the return to corporeality as Marx and Engels intended. This is the, you know, merging of, you know, social and natural history to this, you know, materialist conception of history itself. This is really what I think is the most fundamental takeaway of this book. It's just the real understanding of Marx and Engels through their engagement with this, you know, science of this time period, of how we as human beings, of course, mediate our own, you know, metabolism through our labor at a social level, but how even if we, you know, transition to socialism, this isn't, you know, a guarantee that we can, you know, have harmony of nature, but rather we need to have a mastery of our mastery. You know, we need to realize we can't, you know, master nature in this manner, but rather we need to understand how at the very, very bottom, this universal metabolism of nature both defines us and sets sort of limits.
What we can actually do is I've always kind of wondered about, maybe this is like overly Hegelian, but if there is this contradiction in terms of human beings, like our own like metabolic relationship to nature, it might actually be like resolved, or at least maybe not necessarily through Marx, like in Marx's mind, but resolved through realizing the sort of this, like through a kind of collective realization of that contradiction, sort of in the sense of maybe even, you know, what I kind of think about is because a lot of, I mean, what Mike Davis, for example, talks about at the end of Old Gods, New Enigmas is that the way we could actually get out of the contradiction between, he doesn't put it this way, but the way we could get out of the contradiction between town and country is actually through the building up of urban, through the building up of urban spaces and this, and the kind of pulling everything together more in those spaces, because it would be a more ecologically ecologically sustainable like method of living, right? Because it, you can kind of have all these resources going to a single place rather than in this sort of like dispersed manner into something like the suburbs, or even worse, which would be like, you know, the countryside, which would be allowed to sort of rewild and regrow. especially the suburbs. And maybe part of Marx's thinking, and I'm not quite sure about this that's being articulated here, is that possibility for realization of the contradiction.
It certainly can't be pushed through or like resolved from one side. You know, the solution is obviously not just paving the earth, and it's obviously not burn the cities and factories, let's all just go back to the woods. We have to figure out how to manage this this relationship, and we have to figure out how to restructure our society in a way that that it's not so obviously destructive. And Engels has a very good passage in part of the part played by labor in the transition from ape to man, where he says genuine mastery over nature is not standing over nature as like a foreign conqueror and taking everything from it. You can, every time a society has tried to do that, it has completely exhausted the way that it can live, and it's fallen apart. Genuine mastery of nature is learning nature's laws deeply, and then applying your knowledge and your expertise and your understanding of those laws in a way that's beneficial for human life. And that, I think, is sort of the way we have to think about it. I don't think, you know, absolute degrowth or, you know, pave the earth, you know, human mastery over nature in that sense are answers. And we have to really think about this in a much more complicated way.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I want to save some of the conversation for the later podcasts. I do think that taking a page from like more theoretical biology too, understanding these laws not as like, you know, these definite, you know, like sure laws, but rather these kind of like, you know, informal constraints upon biology itself. I mean, you see through the history of, you know, evolution itself and the kind of active nature, again, you know, drawing upon this, you know, element here of active materialism, practical materialism, species modify the environment as well to beget more and more biodiversity. These aren't like, you know, kind of static laws, but rather we need to conceptualize here that, you know, organisms, including humans, play an active role in creating natures in which we live in, and that what informal laws there might be set a limit for what forms might occur, but it's still not this, like, you know, definite, you know, kind of like, you know, limit to human society, but rather we need to be creative in how we relate to nature, not through, again, this mastery, which will get us in the last end, as Engels says, but rather through understanding these informal laws and really taking an active role in, you know, again, protecting nature, not paving over all of nature, but rather working with a biodiversity and the sort of agency of these natural organisms, whether to be taken from Darwin, the, you know, small and, you know, kind of minor earthworm and their role they're playing now in, like, you know, invading the, you know, sort of northern regions of the northern hemisphere and kind of releasing all of this stored carbon for permafrost as the soils begin to warm over and allow them to proceed. You know, these small organisms have a fundamental role through their own metabolisms in transforming, you know, these nutrients or, you know, kind of, you know, inaccessible carbons to what might be accessible now or vice versa.
All of this points to, and everything that was just said has had me in the mindset of this, but, and as does, of course, the work that we're nominally discussing, but all of this points to the sort of the fundamental, like, nature of Marxism and historical materialism almost as a unifying project in a way, because, like, you know, Matt, you were talking about, like, collective and conscious self-restraint almost, or not even self-restraint, but a deep understanding of, you know, the co-constitution of human society and the rest of nature. And it reminds me a little bit of Christopher Caldwell. You know, his definition of freedom is this idea of almost like collective self-mastery, which would open new vistas of freedom for every individual in the social organism by abolishing class society. But I was thinking, you know, that has a sort of application to the theory of metabolic rift and this dualism that we experience or sort of impute to the world where there's man and nature. And it also reminds me of, like, you know, that whole idea of sort of transcending a subject object divide, or like Nick Estes talks about, colonial onticide. So like the way to, you know, he points to a way forward as sort of like killing the ontology that we inherit from a capitalist, colonialist, Cartesian, and dualist view of the world, which I know we're going to get into all of those things when we talk about Malm and Moore. That's what springs to mind a little bit. I hope that wasn't too bong rip.
But we're all like very excited to go into
Moore. I'm so excited to get into that debate. I can't even express it now. But I think that gives us a perfect transition, like, as to like kind of like contextualizing more of this work too, after 2000. Yeah. I think in the decade, or even two decades now, that, you know, proceed thereafter, you see a huge, huge influence of this work. I mean, this really sets the tone for Marxist ecology. Like, it's not even a matter of whether you're for or against, it's rather you're for or you draw upon it critically. It's one of those things.
Yeah, and I almost kind of worry about that in a certain sense, because if you're very cynical towards Marxism, I could perfectly well see that this is like nearly 300 pages of special pleading.
Yeah, I mean, that's one issue I think I still have with Bosch's work. It's insofar as how it's been still, to this day, to a certain degree, insular to kind of like the pre-existing green theory that's been out there. I'll get into that, I think, in a few minutes, but I want to kind of talk about some of the, you know, direct influences in the decade or two after. Like, you start having, you know, in this decade after, kind of application of metabolic rift and the carbon cycles, as I mentioned before, to, you know, kind of fisheries and aquaculture, to, again, the role of colonialism, as we talked about with the, you know, American kind of, like, you know, experience of soils in the West there, and the role of guano islands, as well as the application to, in the sense of the microbiome and how humans are kind of an assemblage of organisms and how our microbiome defines us, and how, in a sense, industrial society simplifies these things and causes, as actually Robert Wallace, one of the great Marx epidemiologists out there right now, just working upon the conception of how not only do we simplify and create these, you know, kind of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, but also our whole agricultural system is defined by these sort of, like, you know, just cesspools and concentration of organisms that generate the perfect conditions for the development of new pathogens, whether COVID or the swine flu in the past. But again, that'll probably be a future episode, getting into that COVID and pandemics.
Yeah, and we can try to have Rob on for that. I think we'll probably be able to do that.
Actually, today he said he's putting out a new book on COVID and pathogens.
I saw that.
So
yeah, what's it called? Like, The Dead Epidemiologists or something?
Yeah. So I guess the last few things I can get into then are, like, kind of the direct result of, like, you know, Foster's work. And again, this points to the insularity, I think, of metabolic rift to some degree. I mean, first of all, there's a direct influence upon metabolic rift to Jason Moore and the kind of, like, you know, world ecology school. They draw upon metabolic rift critically. But here, I think, gets into some of the sectarianism inherent in the ecological Marxist left. Essentially, with the publication of this work and this, you know, multi-book kind of multi-work, multi-author entire school that comes out, a monthly review mostly, of metabolic rift, you have Foster and Burkett, a close collaborator with Foster, kind of delineating this kind of first, second stage ecosocialism. And I mean, I don't think it's the most useful kind of categorization, but it's useful for understanding metabolic rift and its influence. So Foster and Burkett kind of delineate this first stage ecosocialism. And I mentioned before in the very beginning of this podcast, kind of the role of Schmidt's work on, like, you know, Marx's conception of nature. So what really was occurring in this, like, kind of interim of, like, you know, the late, you know, 70s and 80s was development of alternative theories with the kind of nascent green movement. You have, for instance, Bookchin, but also you have, with the end of the 80s, the start of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. And in the founding article of this, you have this conception by James O'Connor, one of the kind of think, forerunners, I think, for ecological Marxism, of the second contradiction of capitalism. And he draws really heavily on Karl Polanyi's Great Transformation. And here he puts into this sort of underproduction, or the role of, you know, capitalist production's conditions in causing these crises. So Foster kind of going against these early progenitors of ecological Marxism says they're trying to graft this green theory onto Marxism, or vice versa, trying to graft Marxism onto green theory, instead of really going back to Marxist work. So Foster creates this kind of, like, you know, delineation between those like himself and Burkett who really go back to Marxist work and do this kind of archaeology, and those who might have tried to, through the ongoing developments in green theory, you know, develop this alternative approach. So yeah, this first stage ecosocialism, these other authors who tried to kind of graft green theory onto Marxism again, or vice versa, and then second stage ecosocial thinking, where they go back to Marx like Foster and Burkett do, and try to find the ecological context of his materialism and really critically engage with green theory. So they say this is like a long theoretical revolution that takes ecological thought and is challenged as seriously as Marxist bourgeois political economy. And, I mean, to this extent, you have to really, I think, be critical about how these kind of two or even three schools of ecosocialism develop, the non-Marxist, the pre-metabolic rift, and post-metabolic rift schools. But again, you really can't, I think, now find any school that doesn't really at least critically draw a metabolic rift.
No, well, I was just wondering, actually, I don't know if we should get into that on another episode or not. I was going to ask about some of the critical approaches, but that might be for a future episode. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's for sure going to be a future episode.
Yeah.
I think this episode has gone really well, but we probably are getting towards the ceiling of where we want to go with it.
Yeah, yeah. If I can get to like the last, I guess, final threads of this work. Again, this is like a 20-year, like, you know, anniversary of Marxist ecology. So I think in the past, you know, the first decade was the, you know, I think real developments in metabolic rift theory. Some critics say this is the kind of like delineation limits of this theory itself. We'll save that for a future episode. But you start finding, you know, with this, the publication of Marx and Engels Collected Works, MEGA is the acronym in German. They started publishing, like, you know, Marx's ecological journals from this 1865 to 1868 period. And over half of these are natural sciences. I think the actual guy who led the Marx Engels Institute in Moscow complained about how, like, you know, in this, like, late period of Marx's life, when he could barely do research anymore, he's spending all of his time on, like, kind of recapitulating the ideas in these books on geology and, you know, agricultural chemistry.
Yeah. He's like, what the fuck is all this shit?
Yeah, yeah, right?
I don't want to hear about plants.
You start finding here really like how deep Marx and Engels' engagements with the natural sciences are and how fundamental they are to Marxism as it exists. And I mean, this really starts, I think, to pop off in the last decade with, you know, these various green movements. So first of all, you have, you know, Kohai Sato's work. He's pretty involved with that whole, like, you know, mega publication. But then you have, you know, Foster and Burkett really getting into like the connection of like this, like, you know, kind of metabolic rift theory with work in, you know, systems ecology as well as thermodynamics, both between G.E. Hutchinson or H.G. Odum. They're finding these kind of like direct, you know, links in the past with current works. And then even in the past, I think, few years, you have a direct kind of reference by Naomi Klein, who's a really, I think, popular author for this kind of, you know, current climate crisis. She references in This Changes Everything, metabolic rift theory, which is, I think, a sure sign of this kind of nexus between green theory and green praxis. And yeah, I mean, this I think is a really important shift. And I think my final point really is going to be that this year, this 20th anniversary of Marxist ecology marks the sequel, really, to Marxist ecology, the return of nature, starting after the kind of, like, you know, death of both Marx and Darwin. And this really gets into the sort of thread that I don't think we really discussed at all of, you know, Soviet ecology and all these other theorists, whether it's, you know, Kautsky or Bukharin or even the Soviet, I'm sorry?
JBS Haldane.
Yeah, no, Haldane too, Haldane. Yeah, certainly. It gets into more of these relationships between, like, you know, these Marx, Engels, and other Marxists in this milieu to the modern day. So this is, I think, a really important time to tune into Marxist ecology, but it's certainly tumultuous.
Yeah, I mean, this underscores just the utter significance of this field, because the Marxism can't operate, no system really that claims to be cohesive and have a claim towards being possible to be complete can operate with a gaping hole in it. And so that's essentially, what is represented by a focus only on history and society, without a literal the world that we exist in. So this can't be overstated how important both this book and, more importantly, this field of knowledge and knowledges is. And I'm glad we had a chance to get into it. Did folks have any last words on Foster's first contribution before we put the episode
to bed? Well, I do want to say, cosmonaut fans, look out. July, August 2020, I'll put out a review of the new book, The Return of Nature. Hopefully this gives some more, I think, foreground to Foster's original ideas and how much this really concept metabolic rift in Marxist ecological thinking, his materialism, has developed in really recent time.
Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to that.
I will also say it's sort of interesting when Foster, at the end of this book, looks at sort of the subsequent evolution of the Marxist tradition in relation to ecological questions. The two sort of theorists he seizes on as representatives of Marxism that really took nature seriously were Nikolai Bukharin and Christopher Caldwell, who are both big influences, I think, on a lot of people at Cosmonaut, and we've obviously done an episode on Caldwell a while ago, and one on Bukharin a while back. So if anyone's interested in those, they should listen.
Yeah, that is very much the
reminder.
That is very much like the monthly review. Those are kind of the holy pairing at the monthly review.
Yeah, and with good reason. I mean, I think that we pretty much align pretty well with that. If you throw in a little bit of Bogdanov and Stafford Beer and cybernetics. I mean, that's the whole thing. And people, I think, express this, and I think maybe poorly, when they say, Marxism is a science, and you can evaluate that claim however you want. But I think what they're pointing to is that, the potential here for historical materialism, dialectical materialism, whatever you want to say, really, I think, is unique in that it is the only sort of theoretical or I hesitate to say philosophical frame that can accommodate a holistic, coherent understanding. Which would be incomplete without the rest of the natural sciences. Yeah, on that note, guys, it's been really good talking. I hope none of this got too bong rip, although I can't imagine that it did for us.
Listen, I got to talk about Tyrannosaurus rexes, so I'm happy.
I'll get out to my bong grip ideas later on, but certainly, hopefully, this is going to be a good outlet for my own ecological Marxist, definitely ecological background. So look forward to, I guess, future installments of the series. We'll probably plan on getting more into these kind of significant works, whether it is this kind of debate between, Moore's school of world ecology and the metabolic rift school, or we might go back into, works like, The Dialectical Biologist by Lemons and Lewontin, and other really, I think, crucial milestones in the development of this truly ecological Marxism.
Yeah, and what I'm also really excited about is also with regards to world ecology and metabolic rift theory, the kind of directions both of these frameworks take in relation to the question of like the origins of capitalism, which is definitely my home turf.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll see a lot more of that with Malm to some extent more when we revisit this. And I think I would like to aim. I mean, obviously, this is. Pursuant to everybody's scheduling needs, but if we could try to do these once every, maybe 2 or 3 weeks from each installment, just to keep the series current and going, I think that would be a good schedule to try.
We can actually aim for shorter works in the future as well, in case there's an issue of timing. But I think we're mostly prepared to already discuss kind of more Malm dispute, but.
Yeah,
I would really love to start delving into these kind of works more. As far as I know, there's been no real attempt to kind of like historicize or kind of like, demarcate the ways in which this green Marxism has developed. So hopefully this podcast can be an outlet for people who might be new to these ideas to really get a foothold and start getting into this nitty-gritty stuff.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, guys, I think I'm going to do our little outro here. So listeners, we hope that you enjoyed this, and we hope that this sparks interest in the ecological Marxist and more complete Marxist revolution that we are fortunate enough to be living in the midst of. I'd just like to remind folks that you can find this and all of our other audio, written, and soon to be print content at www.cosmonaut.blog. We are soon to have our novel, first ever English translation of a work by Karl Kautsky called The Historic Accomplishment of Karl Marx. One of our Cosmonaut editors translated that from the German for us, and it has come from the print shops and is ready to be distributed. We've got all that and more. You can get access to those, some t-shirts, buttons, soon to be bound pamphlet length books on a variety of topics, including a series called Shop Talks, one on history and lessons we can learn from the CIO and how to apply them to a model of insurgent organizing today. And of course, get early access to our audio content at Patreon. You can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/cosmonautmagazine. You can find us on Facebook at Cosmonaut Mag and Twitter as well at the same handle. So definitely stay tuned in with us. You can join our collective study group, the Yuri Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center. And all of that is accessible through our Patreon at, I believe, the $10 Salyut tier. So until we see you guys again, we hope that you'll check those things out. Support us if you can. You know, leave us some feedback, some comments in our Facebook group that we have or on the page. We'd love to hear from you. Until then, solidarity.
Oh, man.